inner monologue that's kind of running through us. How do we shut that up, Kirsten?
You don't. You never can. You never will. Research has shown that emotional suppression, trying to push down our emotions or our feelings, just makes them louder.
Imposter syndrome. What are your thoughts on it? How do you think we should be reframing it?
Our evolutionary mechanism, which is thriving within us still today, is telling us constantly, be quiet, stay small, don't let anybody see you. Because if you do that, you'll be safe and you won't die. So instead of saying you're underperforming, for example, I would say, if you felt as though you were doing a better job, what would you be doing differently? We might find that we have our best ideas in the shower. You don't have your best ideas in the shower. It's just that's the only time you can hear them. Would you want to put me on the spot even more?
Please.
Give me something that you might sell, and I will tell you how to turn it into a story, and I'll do it on the spot.
Kirsty Hulse, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure, our pleasure. So we always start our podcast off the same way. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Mm-hmm. Well, who am I? So my name is Kirsty Hulse. I'm the founder of a company called Raw Training, the creator of Europe's biggest confidence conference, Confidence Live, and I'm the CEO of a talent tech platform, NeuroWorks. And I solve people problems in businesses.
People problems. Go on, give me the symptoms of a people problem in business that gets you hot under the collar.
You have an incredibly talented team who don't believe in themselves or struggle to speak up, or you're trying to hire and it's taking you forever and you want to have a lovely diverse team, but you're not finding diverse candidates and you're not sure how to do that. People are overworked and burnt out and stressed and you don't know why. Those are some of them.
That feels like one of those things. So AI is obviously like the hot topic this year. Oh. That feels like a problem no AI would ever solve.
I think actually AI is, I'm quite a pro AI person. I'm not one of these like end of days. I definitely think AI will get us a lot closer to solving a lot of people problems because, you know, what I do is training. And AI can now do that really effectively. So now people can access like tools and resources that can help them self-manage and manage their emotions at work a lot better. AI can really support the hiring process. It can feel a bit sticky, but there's lots of actually really wonderful AI tools that people can use. So I actually think that AI will create more spaciousness so that we have a bit more room. And I think it will help people focus on the things that actually we as humans are incredibly good at. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that it will be like a kind of industrial revolution and the business equivalent of having a dishwasher for the first time and being like, wow, I don't have to stand and wash my dishes. That's my hope. I'm an optimist. I'm a technical optimist.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. Kirsty, thank you so much for joining us. I'm a big lover of life hacks, and obviously AI has been brought in to make our life easier. If we think about life hacks, what are three actionable things that people can do before maybe a high stakes meeting or a big presentation to make sure that they feel confident?
Love that, Jack. Thank you. So the first one is stop clicking through your slides, pull back. So often before a high stakes meeting where they're like panic preparing, that energy before an exam and you're like going through your notes, it's too late. Stop. In that instance, it's better to, so that's the first tip. In that instance, it's better to, the second tip is just take a huge, big, deep breath several times. If you're someone who gets shaky hands, shaky legs, that's natural, that's normal. Move. That's just your body's generated a lot of energy and it wants to expend it. So try not to just sit if you can. Like if it's a virtual thing, just go and just literally physically shake. Hide in a toilet cubicle if you can. And then the third thing is know that if you're nervous about a high stakes situation, yes, welcome to your humanity. Like we all get nervous. That's part of the process, and actually kind of welcoming those nerves and not villainizing them is really important.
Do you find, I sometimes think of those like high stakes situations as sometimes you're maybe talking somebody down from a ledge. Like what are some of the things you can tell yourself in those moments to kind of bring yourself back to normality?
Yes. So when you say talking somebody down from a ledge, do you mean like you're talking to somebody else, or that's how we talk to ourselves?
Well, I think it's that kind of situation of like, I imagine when just before I might enter a high stakes situation, I'll think about some of the things I could say to myself as if I was talking somebody down from a ledge. So it's kind of that inner monologue that's kind of running through us. How do we shut that up, Kirsty?
You don't. You never can. You never will, and you don't try. Because here's the thing, people try and fix it. People try and fix self-doubt with self-doubt. So often what we do, we have that inner monologue, or it might be an inner critic or a mean voice, or just that like constant, that's just part of who we are. And I want, maybe if you think about that as say a child that's kind of pulling on your coat, being like, am I okay? Am I okay? Am I gonna die? Which is what we do as humans. If you were trying to shut that child up, it would just get louder. Whereas actually, if we go, hey, I hear you, thank you, like I've got this, that's the way to soften the voice through kind of welcoming. It feels counterintuitive, but through welcoming it in, listening to it, then it actually gets a little softer. Research has shown that emotional suppression, trying to push down our emotions or our feelings, just makes them louder. So my answer to your question is we don't stop the voice, we hear the voice, and then we just try and not give it too much power.
I love that analogy. I feel like in every podcast, there's always something that I take away and I kind of carry forward and share with friends. And I think that's already, I've already, I feel like I've ticked a box. I feel like there's going to be loads more to take away. What can people be doing in their spare time then ahead of those situations, not to silent the voice, but to have a better conversation with their self-doubt, their worry, their fear of rejection?
Lovely question. So often when we're in a moment of self-doubt or fear or nerves or anxiety or whatever it is, that's often a bit too late to do anything about it. So I always talk about confidence is a habit. It's not a personality trait. It's not a feeling. It's a set of actions that you consistently practice. And so it's about knowing what they are for you. So what I'll often ask people is, Jack, what are the specific 5-minute actions that relax you, that chill you out? Small, tiny. So for a lot of people, that might be staring out of the window, getting out, having a cup of tea, stroking my dog. And then I would say, okay, awesome. What are those quick, small 5-minute actions that energize you, that make you feel excited? So for people, that's sometimes dancing or listening to music or picturing something going really well. And then, in order to be more confident in life broadly, we focus on those actions with as much regularity as possible. And when we direct our attention towards the action, the feeling is often a happy side effect.
Amazing. Amazing. I love it. I feel like I want to run through a wall already. So let's see where
Yes,
we end up by
Zach.
the end of this.
I believe in the ability to run through a wall.
next big topic. So we're hitting you with all the big topics. Imposter syndrome. What are your thoughts on it? How do you think we should be reframing it?
I'm going to say something naughty here. Imposter syndrome, it doesn't exist. In the fact that it does, we
Wow.
experience it. But I don't think it's helpful to say imposter syndrome, because what I noticed, and I've worked with probably about 70,000 people now on confidence. So I have these conversations like day in, day out, and people will come up to me and say, I've got imposter syndrome. And the problem with that is when people say that, they are somehow telling themselves they are not good enough, they are wrong, and they have a syndrome. That's not how you build confidence. So instead of imposter syndrome, and I'm not denying the feeling, the feelings are so real, but instead of saying something like imposter syndrome, a huge part is this like, well, you're a human. Humans experience doubt. We literally evolved to avoid ridicule. We literally evolved to not put our head above the parapet. our evolutionary mechanism, which is thriving within us still today, is telling us constantly, be quiet, stay small, don't let anybody see you, because if you do that, you'll be safe and you won't die. And so the fact that many of us move through our lives experiencing imposter syndrome, experiencing self-doubt, experiencing worry, is the most natural, normal, everyday thing. And it certainly isn't a syndrome. It's a natural expression of growth and learning, I think. I think if you're doing...
So it sounds like...
There you go.
I was going to say, it sounds like what you're saying there is then it's more akin to growing pains than having some sort of illness.
Growing pains is a lovely way to describe it. You know, and actually we can use that as a metaphor. You know, when children grow and their bones start hurting, you are not going to be like, oh, you've got tall boy syndrome. You're like, you wouldn't say that. It's weird. You'd be like, yeah, cool. Like, that's really exciting. It means you're getting taller and you're entering a new chapter. And if, as humans, we often think we're scared of the thing. So we think we're scared of public speaking, or we think we're scared of asking someone out on a date, or whatever it is. But we're not necessarily scared of the thing. We're scared of the unknown. It's uncertainty that we're scared of. And so if you put yourself in any situation where there's a bit of uncertainty, which is speaking on a podcast, you know, speaking up in a meeting, whatever it is, that is almost entirely and universally going to be met with some feelings of fear. That's just the way it goes. That's how we're built. We didn't evolve to be like, yes, queen. We evolved to be like, will I die? Will this kill me?
I love that. I want to talk to you about leadership. It can be a bit of a buzzword, but what I really, really want to give the audience is something very kind of tangible. If you are a leader that is trying to motivate their team and not discourage them or demotivate them, what is the best framework to give feedback and criticism?
Okay, lovely. There's so many different feedback frameworks. I have a personal favorite. And for me, the best way to give feedback is to start with questions. So let's say, for example, you have somebody on your team who's consistently underperforming. They miss deadlines. They're late. They're just not quite there. Now, you could tell them that. But the problem with telling people that is feedback has been shown time and time again. It can make us defensive. It can cognitively close us down. I know we've all had those moments where someone's given us some feedback and we're like, don't know about that, actually. So it's often difficult for leaders to have their message heard. So instead of saying you're underperforming, for example, I would say, if you felt as though you were doing a better job, what would you be doing differently? That's an intentionally constructed question. This, if you felt that you were doing a better job, they have to picture it, they have to imagine it. What would you be doing differently? And then what we do is most individuals can answer questions like that. Yes, it might take some time. They might be like, I don't know, but people will get there. And then the feedback is coming from them. It's coming from within. And then it's a lot easier for leaders to have their messages heard. So that would be where I start every single time, especially if you're giving more personality-based feedback, be more confident, be more strategic, have more initiative. Like, what do those things mean? I would always start with an if-based question. If you felt you were delivering better work for clients, if you were being more open-minded, if you were being more confident, you think of the ideal scenario you want that individual to do, and then you go, what would you be doing differently? And you kind of bat it back. And then you ask questions like, okay, what are your options to do more of that? So questions, questions, questions. I think questions are a superpower that we don't use enough. And when we've asked those questions, if we're still struggling, then yes, we can be prescriptive and clear and short and direct. But start with questions. It always surprises people how powerful they are.
That's a beautiful question. That's going in my notebook straight away. So say, if we keep going down that path, Kirsty, so we take them down the question path and we're getting there, but it probably requires maybe a bit more tough love, or the answers aren't as obvious. How would you deliver that effectively?
Then I would deliver it so succinctly And I think what's important with feedback is the delivery is more important than the message. And what's important is when we're communicating, humans are leaky, and we might think that we're just communicating a thing with our words, but actually the majority of our language is nonverbal. So I think the most important thing when giving difficult feedback, like we as the givers of the feedback have to be chill. Like if we're nervous, if we're stuttering, if we're stumbling, if we're like, well, you know, you're good, you are good, but also like that's going to be bordering on impossible for somebody to happily receive. So I think the most important thing when having very difficult conversations is to make sure that you as the leader giving it, you're not annoyed, you're not nervous, you're not stressed, you've got some like cool apathy, you're bringing like a surgeon talking to you, you know, like a doctor wouldn't be like, oh my God, it's really bad. We have to be neutral in our feedback. We have to be neutral and it has to be fast because it's painful. So make it quick and make it easy.
I love that. Let's stick with this then. Let's stick with this theme on leadership. So people often, I think, struggle to connect with their team. It almost feels like they're separate from their team. But it's been shown that people who feel like they really believe in their leadership tend to perform better. I know, shock horror. Where do you think people go wrong in being connected to their teams as leaders?
I think they try to be connected to their teams. Okay. So one of the things I notice is companies will have like employee engagement initiatives. And so they'll be like, right, we're going to get together as a team and we're going to go to the pub, for example, or we're going to go for dinner. Like those are great. But what companies rarely do is sit down and say to an individual, what would you like from me as a leader? We don't ask. We never ask someone what would make you feel like genuinely like you wanted to come to work. And the thing is it will be different for everyone. And so I think the reason that people often struggle to meaningfully connect with their teams is because they're trying to tell them how to connect. They're like, we are going to do connection now. This is how we will do it. That doesn't work. You do connection through listening. And we don't do enough of that. So if people want to connect more with their teams, I would sit down with them and say, I want us to have a really good working relationship. Like what would that look like for you? What do you want from me as a leader? And then do that.
Why do you think that's not happening?
Because we are so used to feeling like we need to have the answers. And I think there is, you know, businesses are often, even the businesses that aren't, are still quite like there's a hierarchy. People will look up to their team. And I know for me, like earlier in my management and leadership experience, I thought I had to know the answers. I think that's quite tied in. Whereas actually we don't have to know anything as leaders. It's better if we go in with no agenda and we'll go in open-minded. And I think it's not happening because just the fundamental nature of business is like, we'll come together as a leadership team in a committee and we'll come up with an initiative. Like that's just what companies do. And often we just forget to do the most obvious thing. Because we have these layers of like tradition.
And then a big word for 2024, and I think it'll probably be the same for 2025, has been burnout and managing teams effectively. And I believe, I don't want to butcher the quote, but I think you said something like, our most creative ideas are sat in a big pile of no's.
Yes, that is me.
That is you. Good. What does that actually mean for you, Kirsty? What does that actually look like?
So a lot of teams are burnt out. And often people think it's because we have too much work to do. It almost is nearly never that. It's not the volume of work that creates burnout. It's the way we work that creates burnout. It's the intensity we bring to our work that creates burnout. So most people are trying to do 35,000 things at once. They're trying to read their emails, look at Slack or look at Teams and check their social media. And we're kind of working like this. Our attention is so fractured and that is cognitively draining. Like, do you ever get to the end of your working week and you're exhausted, burnt out, drained, but you've not done anything? we spend like so much of our mental energy. Can I swear?
Please.
We spend so much of our mental energy just dicking around. Like, oh, I'm going to open this tab or I'm going to do that. Whereas actually, if we want to, I'm fundamentally can be quite lazy. I want to have the most impact with the least effort. The way you do that is by limiting distractions, shutting down as much mental bandwidth as you possibly can, and trying to do a thing, complete it, do the next thing, complete it, do a thing, complete it. And that's very hard in our busy working environments. But if we can do just a bit more of that, that helps reduce burnout. And also, creativity requires space. Like, you can't be creative in a noisy brain, because fundamentally new ideas are neurologically quiet. So if you're trying to come up with a new campaign strategy, a new sales strategy, you're trying to solve a problem, that's maybe a thought you don't think very often. So in the, you know, the busyness of our brains, think of it as like a snow globe. So if we already always have this like shaken up snow globe, all of the like smaller bits of innovation and creativity and new things, they don't get heard. That's why we might find that we have our best ideas in the shower. You don't have your best ideas in the shower. It's just that's the only time you can hear them. You're having amazing ideas all the time, but literally they will only surface in your brain in those moments when your brain starts to quiet down. That's why, I don't know about you two, but if I'm falling asleep, your brain starts to kind of mellow, and then it's like, boom, here's a load of cool stuff to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you annoy your partner by grabbing for a notepad or a phone and say, no, it'll be gone by the morning. So I love that. Out of all the swear words you could have chose, Kirsty, I did expect dicking, but I was impressed with it. I think it's great. Great choice of words. I think it's a great point that you make. I'm a big fan of like gamifying things. So for people, like what you talk about there is a great idea, and like I'm so with it. But people won't be doing it. So how do we convince people to like gamify their life so they are shutting down their distractions? They are being more effective. They are focusing on the task at hand.
So it's interesting to note, my response, as I'm having resistance to that, I'm like, the gamification of things is the problem. So let's say, for example, I don't have children, but I have nieces and nephews. So let's say that I took my 10-year-old nephew to a video arcade, and he's there, and he's like, he'd be going mad, right? He's running around, he's eating chocolate, he wants an unlimited amount of pound coins that makes it phenomenally expensive. And then if I suddenly said to him, oh, could you just sit down in this video arcade and do your maths homework? He'd be like, no. But we wouldn't then be like, oh, my nephew, he's so lazy. Like, look at him being so lazy. We'd just be like, this isn't the right environment for him to do his best work. But as adults, we don't do that. So actually my response to the gamification is, I would say, let's learn to rely less on gamification, and let's slowly relearn what I call mental discipline. And that's the ability to go, I'm going to stop, or I'm going to focus, or I'm going to do one thing at a time. It doesn't happen overnight, but the world we live in is not actually conducive for us to do our best work. It's a video game arcade. Like, that's the notifications and all of that. Like, it literally does a very similar thing. So my genuine worldview is that every single individual on this planet, every single one of us, needs to regain control of our ability to pull back. So your question is awesome, but I have an ideological worldview that's the opposite.
I saw a quote the other day that said something like, all of our problems could be solved if we could sit in silence for half an hour in a room. Obviously, we live in a world where you can't do that. But it's interesting, because you're exactly right. When you were saying that then, Jack will often say to me, can you try and solve this problem on a dog walk? Because he knows if I'm out walking my dogs, he's going to get a text saying, oh, why don't we try this? Why don't we do this instead? And what you've just said makes me think it's not the dog walk, it's the silence. So yeah. Something in that, you've held the mirror up to me there.
Well, which, anecdotally, we all know we tend to do our best thinking, at least when we're not working, but the science supports it. There's loads of research on how, like, stepping away, new environment, doing something new, not trying to solve a problem is the way to do it. But we feel very, the reason we don't do it is guilt. Guilt and presenteeism gets in our way.
Interesting. Okay. It's left me with something to unpack. So personal brand, that's another thing that gets thrown around a lot. I see a lot of shorts on LinkedIn and I think, I have no idea what that means. I don't know why that would be useful. Send more voice notes, take better pictures, talk about sob stories more. What's your relationship with personal brand? What have you found actually works?
For me personally, the thing that I found actually works, I have never thought about it ever. I've never thought like, okay, what's my personal brand going to be? What am I going to do? It was always an accident that came out of me sharing things that felt genuinely meaningful for me and actually of service. That's very much perhaps not in vogue at the moment, because I think a lot of people, there are really useful frameworks. But I think for me, personal brand, when you think about, I am going to build a brand to get some stuff, I think the energy's off. Whereas if you change it to, what information do I have? What expertise do I have? And how can I be of service to people? Then I think it's better. So for me, instead of thinking about personal brand, I think perhaps a more helpful thing to think about is how can you be of value to a community? And I think that question gets us closer to something that is actually useful. And something really practical is, if you say to someone, like, how could you be of value to a community? Most people are like, I fucking don't know how I can be of value to a community. But if you say to somebody, think about your job or think about your industry, what really annoys you about it? People can reel stuff off. And then you go, how would you solve that? And that's it. That's the thing. Those are your content types. Those are your topics. Think about what annoys you and how would you solve it? And then suddenly you have then your voice, your personal brand, your identity. It's easier for us to get there through thinking what annoys us than thinking about, like, our value.
So then it sounds like what you're saying is the issue is people do it without the right intention behind it. They're not asking themselves the right questions before they start.
Yes. And I think that's entirely unsustainable as well. You know, I imagine so many people listening to this podcast have been like, right, this is the year, this is the year I'm going to post on LinkedIn every day. And it doesn't stick, because that's so unfulfilling. If we're doing things to get a reward and the reward doesn't come, we will stop doing it pretty fast. But if we're doing things and the reward is, I think this might help someone somewhere, we're much more likely to stick with it. So I have built all my businesses have come from my personal brand that I've built over a decade plus through consistently just trying to be useful, just be useful.
There's something so beautiful about kind of consistency and the reps. And I was talking to somebody about it today. It's going to sound weird, but one of my hobbies at the moment is I'll go to YouTube channels or podcast channels on YouTube that I enjoy. And instead of looking at the most popular videos, I'll click oldest and I'll see how far they've come and see how long they've been grafting at it and see where they started out. And typically there's some kind of consistency that's kind of developed. When you were talking there, it made me think about, like, skills and, like, I like to think of skills as like tools that you keep in a toolbox. And actually, you might have humor as one of your skills, but if you go into a really hard disciplinary, you're not going to take that out. You're not going to tighten a bolt. You're not going to use a hammer. So it's about being kind of effective. What do you think are some of the most underrated skills that human beings can keep in their locker that they should be learning to become better humans?
Stress tolerance is like the skill, I think, especially if you're a leader. Like, so many of most businesses are all a bit stressed for literally no reason. So most of us are like, oh my God, I've got this thing to do. I've got this deadline to do. Do you remember that time you were looking at your to-do list and you had so much stuff to do and you're like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to do it. I've got too much to do. And then you got it done and it was fine. Literally every time. And so every time, but we're all walking around being like, oh my God, oh my God. And so I think this, almost this like apathy, this like, I can't, it's not quite apathy, but it's this like, this deep knowing that actually everything is fine, this stress tolerance, I think is maybe the most valuable skill, especially if you manage people and you lead teams, because we project our stress onto other people. If you're a stressed leader, you can tell people to chill, take their holidays, take a break all day long, but they won't because you're giving them your stress. So I think stress tolerance, and the way you develop that is by just consistently reinforcing this, I've got it. And a nice way to do that is every single time you find yourself, I did it for myself this morning. You get an email that's frustrating and annoying. Ask yourself a question. How will I feel about this in 6 months? Won't care. I won't care. And I think we will all do our better work from that mindset. I really believe that, because we still do things. We get things done, but without this like intensity that I think we can sometimes carry, that is quite a hindrance. That's one of them.
What else is in there? Go on, keep them coming, Kirsty.
I don't know why. Okay, so stress tolerance. Also, I think another, I don't know, my mind's gone blank now. You were like, give me more. And I was like, I've got a blank. My stress tolerance is low.
Let's talk about humor then. So humor is huge when it comes to communications. It's you say it's a powerful tool. So how can we use humor to connect with the audience? The issue will be a lot of people hear this and they're not like me and you, Kirsty. They might be a bit more like Zach, that they're not naturally funny. So how do they use that tool if they feel like they're not naturally funny?
I didn't know we were doing that today. All right, if we're doing that, fine.
Okay, so the good news about humor is, again, all the skills that I teach, humor, confidence, motivation, they are skills, they're not personality traits. So actually, there's quite a practical way that anybody can apply a bit more humor into their working environment. So there's two different things. There's play and there's humor. They're separate. Play is collaborative. So play is when you, I don't know, think of like a team game, or you're just telling jokes in a meeting. That's when it's as a group. That's play, more of that. And then there's humor. Humor you would use maybe in a presentation. A way that you can, a simple way that anybody can use a bit more humor in a way that isn't divisive, is through something that I call relatable truths. So every single company and every single individual will have something called relatable truths, which are the thing that everybody knows is true, but nobody's really saying it. They're incredibly unifying. They're often very funny. So some examples of relatable truths would be, I don't know, in an office trying to eat a crunchy Muller Corner at your desk, that like moment when it's quiet and you're trying to eat a crunchy snack. That's a relatable truth. A relatable truth would be the feeling that we all have of like a genuine dread before we speak to that client. That would be a relatable truth. So my advice would be, find your relatable truths. Like, what are the things that everybody knows is true? And then you just whip them in and you throw them in your presentation, and you'll get what just happened is people will smile and nod. And then what we're doing is, laughter can absolutely be the shortest distance between two people, provided we're using it as a way to create connection. And I think just universal truths is a simple, practical, easy way to do that. Find your universal truths, tell them in a meeting, and you'll see that like, oh my God, yeah, oh, that's me too. And we all have them and they're lovely.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. That's such a good answer. It got me thinking about presentations and public speaking, and you're an amazing public speaker. I can say that without feeling like I'm lying, which sometimes we have to. But no, you're really, really good. I love watching you speak. I love doing the research for this podcast. So if you're someone like Jack, that when he gives public talks or presentations, people look quite confused at the end of it and they don't really know what he was talking about. What tips would you have to make your presentation more succinct and impactful?
Okay, one quick tip. 1 point per slide with total clarity on why you're telling the audience that. If you find you're giving presentations and people are like, sorry, can you go back a slide? We're creating cognitive dissonance because normally we're trying to give too much information. So make sure you have 1 point per slide. A slightly more advanced thing is match the words on the slide to the words that you're saying. Often they don't. So imagine that you are trying to buy a new pair of shoes and you go to the checkout and the checkout's like first name, last name, family name, middle name, and it's asking for the same information but in a different way. It's confusing and will bounce. It's the same when you're presenting to people. If you have a slide that says something like project governance and jargony text on it, but the words you're saying is different, it's too much for people. And if they're like going like that, if you want people to just follow along, I would rather see a presentation that has 100 slides you move through quickly than slides that are very dense on information. And that the if you say, we have crushed it this quarter, if those are the words coming out of your mouth that you're likely to say, get them on the slide. Because it's so lovely for people. It's just this kind of, it's clear, it's simple. Someone's not trying to read something and intercept it with what you're saying. If audiences are looking confused specifically.
Take notes, Jack. If people are pitching, so I imagine part of your job is giving people pitches. Have you found that there's a way of presenting a pitch, like a framework that's something you really rely on?
Forgive me when I say this. I have never lost a pitch once. I will at some point, but I'm on a streak. And I think the reason for that is I don't care at all about formality. Couldn't give a toss, actually. I hate it. And I think that is the thing that gets in the way of people being able to present well. Because what a good pitch is, whether you are a plumber or in a sales director in a business, like whatever it is that you do, a good pitch is not informational, it's emotional. But what we tend to do is go, here's our features, let me walk you through our platform, let me talk to you about our pricing table, for example. People don't buy based on what they know, people buy based on how they feel. So if anybody is delivering a pitch, my almost non-negotiable would be to ask yourself the question, are there any incidents from my professional life that convey the point I am ultimately trying to make, and then share the story first at the very least. And then you can go into the features and the products and all of that stuff. But if you say are trying to ultimately tell someone, we are the best provider of this, if that's really what you're trying to say, then give me a genuine real life example of that and tell it to me. And tell it to me with specificity. Sometimes when we think about stories, people will tell like a chronology. In 2019, this happened in 2000. That's not a story. A good story is I knew that we were going to win that award the moment I saw the other entries. I knew that we were a fantastic business the moment I saw the phone ring. Like specific, like boom, you're immediately hooked. And other people aren't doing that because they're not brave enough, because we have all of these rules that you have to be formal or serious, and it gets in the way. We love stories as humans. And whatever it is you're selling, you can do more emotionally driven communication just by like easing up on the things you have in your head about what it means to be a professional.
Could I put you on the spot, Kirsty? Could I ask for like an example? Because what you're saying there about pitching and emotion and storytelling is great. It can come from any of your pitches. But what is a great example from a story that you might have said that you recognize from your professional life that just ties it together for the people listening?
Yes. So everything I'll give. So let me try and think. Do you want to put me on the spot even more?
Please.
Give me something that you might sell and I will tell you how to turn it into a story, and I'll do it on the spot.
Okay. So, well, one of the things that we offer is sales training.
Okay, lovely. So you offer sales training. So how do you do that at the moment? Like, what's your normal process?
So I would sit down with somebody. I'd have a discovery call. I'd find out why they need sales training, what happens if they don't have sales training, what happens if the salespeople don't get better. I'd explain how I'm going to deliver on that.
I love that. What I would do, this is an exaggerated example to illustrate the point. So instead of going, we deliver sales training, I would open with a slide of a picture of somebody, and I would open it. The first thing I would say, this is why you have to be brave. The first thing I would say is, I would go, this is Dave. A few years ago, Dave was really upset, really struggling, wasn't hitting his targets. And actually, as a business, we really didn't know how to support him. Dave recently bought a new house. He has enough like space in his work life to go to his kids' sports day. And the reason Dave has seen this big transition is because of the sales training that we delivered. Dave's just one example, but we've worked with loads of different companies, blah, 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 blah.
Wow. I like it, Kirsty. I want to buy. Are you selling? Can I give you some money? I like it. I'm always like, and I know that kind of, I feel like I could talk to you all day, but like, I want to make sure we get the most out of it. What's the one piece of advice that you received throughout your career that you carry very closely to you and you pass on where possible?
So it's not from my career. I'm very fortunate. I'm just going to add one more thing on stories before I answer that question, because I think it's an important point. Tell stories, but make them short. Too long, tedious. It's got to be quick. That's important. Anyway. So I'm fortunate in that I grew up in a big family. I've got four older brothers. And in my family, we have an expression, which is get amongst it. And it's that, like, you know, don't go to a wedding and be like standing around the buffet, not wanting to start. Don't stand on the edge, just get amongst it. And so I was raised in like this kind of like northern rowdy culture of people just like getting amongst it. And I have that in my head all the time. You know, those moments when I'm like, oh, I don't want to make that cold call, just get amongst it. And there's something like fun about that. So I think in terms of advice, that I always say that to people, get amongst it. Like, give it a go. Who cares?
I love it. And then if people are listening to this and you could recommend any books to become a better person, a better leader, a better communicator, better storyteller, what are the books that spring to mind on that, Kirsty?
You know what? I've got more on the shelf here, so I'll show you. So this is a book called Mindset by a woman called Dr. Carol Dweck. Everybody should read this if you're in a environment where you have to fail a lot. So if you're in a rejection heavy environment, if you're getting lots of no's, Mindset is a really good book. If you are someone who wants to write better content, The Serious Guide to Joke Writing. Like, you can sit in this and you can learn, literally like learn how to write jokes. And then the last one is a book called, it's not on my shelf. It's called Self-Compassion. And it's by an author called Dr. Kristen Neff. And if you are someone who beats yourself up, gives yourself a hard time, research has consistently shown time and time again that people who are kinder than to themselves succeed more, are more likely to hit their goals than people who are not kind to themselves. And honestly, I should be on some kind of commission for that book, because I recommend it all the time, but it's genuinely phenomenal. So those are the three books I'd recommend.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kirsty. And you just sorted out my Christmas present for Zach there. I'm going to get him the joke writing one. Kirsty, if people have loved this conversation today, which I'm sure they have because we have, and I don't say that lightly, like there's so many in edit, I'll be writing down with a pen and paper, and I'll be kind of typing all this stuff up for my own personal journal. Where can people find you if they want to work with you? What should they be doing to get in touch with you?
I think the best place to find me is on my LinkedIn, which is my name, Kirsty Hulse, and my website, kirstyhulse.com. I'm fortunate in that I have a unique name, so I am incredibly findable on the internet.
Lovely. Kirsty, thank you so much for taking the time today. I've loved this conversation.
Genuinely, thank you for asking very like precise, difficult questions. I really appreciate that. It was good fun.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.